Welcome to The Middle Ground, an audio series highlighting literature and exploring literary communities across Central and Eastern Europe.
In this episode, host Joe Williams speaks with Slovene author Goran Vojnovic and translator Olivia Hellowell about Goran's novel, The Fig Tree. Joe began by asking Goran and Olivia to introduce themselves.
So, my name is Goran Vojnovic and I'm a writer from Slovenia. I also make films and I do write for theater and write for newspapers, but I think literature is the thing that makes me most occupied and forces me to express myself in the best possible way, I think.
Yeah, I'm Olivia. I'm a translator based in Nottingham. I don't earn my living full-time from translation. I'm also an academic. I teach translation studies at the University of Nottingham. But I've been very lucky to have the opportunity to translate a few novels and children's books from Slovene in the past few years. And by far, my favourite project so far has been Goran's book, The Fig Tree.
Great, thank you. So before we get into the book itself, and there's a lot to talk about in the book, Olivia, what was your first motivation that got you interested in and involved in literature from Slovene and translating from Slovene? Because it's not a literary culture that has a particularly high profile amongst English language readers, which is, you know, regrettable, obviously. But what made you seek out Slovene as a working language?
I suppose there's two things at play there. One of them that goes a bit, quite a bit further back is that my granddad was an incredibly talented linguist. He never got to use languages as his job, but he would always learn languages wherever he went anywhere in the world. And it's one of my clearest childhood memories is seeing all the different books on his shelves in different languages and being fascinated by this idea. Like, I would open a book with him and ask him to translate a sentence for me. And then I would match up word for word and say, so this word means this one and this one means this one. And he would say, no. And I was like, what do you mean? This is the third word and this is the third word in the sentence. And him saying, no, it doesn't work like that. And I just remember my mind being blown by the way that languages worked as a system. And it wasn't as black and white as my small brain wanted it to be. So that's the real reason where that curiosity for language learning comes from. But in a more straightforward sense with Slovene, I was really lucky that I studied Spanish and Russian at university. I'd studied Russian from scratch, again, purely out of curiosity, really. I really wanted to travel to Russia. I knew that I wouldn't have the opportunity to do that in the way that I wanted unless I spoke the language. So that's almost entirely what I based my kind of degree choice on. But one of my Russian lecturers also spoke Slovene and was a translator from Slovene. And Nottingham does have this connection with the university in Ljubljana, and Slovene was taught, fortunately isn't anymore, but it was taught at Nottingham for 40 years. And so I was encouraged just by a really helpful Russian translation lecturer. I was encouraged to pursue that, and I applied for some funding when I graduated. I applied for jobs and I applied for this funding, and the funding was the thing that came through. So I had this scholarship to stay and learn Slovene intensively for a year as a postgraduate. And I had 15 hours tuition one-on-one a week. I was the only person that did it. And we had a native speaker based at the university at the time. So I'd had conversation. I had grammar classes with my Russian translation lecturer. And just the leap in progress that you can make when you are granted the opportunity to study a language in that way. You know, I felt after a year that my Slovene was stronger than my Russian, really, which is sad, but I'd had many other things to do and much fewer hours of Russian per week. So when I was just focused on the Slovene, it was amazing what I felt I could do. And then paired with the fact that Nottingham has this link with the University of Ljubljana, the Centre for Slovene as a Second Foreign Language is incredibly supportive. There are a lot of funded programs that support the learning of Slovene as a second foreign language. And so that support was something that allowed me to pursue this. Without that investment from the Slovene side of things, I wouldn't have known what to do with that knowledge or, you know, how to take it further. That was really key. And big shout out for the Centre for Slovene, who are amazing.
Okay, thanks for that. It's reassuring to hear about people having positive experiences with language learning at UK universities, because they're, you know, sadly rare these days, you know.
Yeah, it, it's something I feel sad about too, but I was incredibly lucky and I've always felt incredibly well supported by the people that taught me. That's why I've stayed with it, really. I hope to be able to do the same for future students too.
Good luck with that. And coming to you now, Goran, and staying on the subject of Slovene literature and Slovene language, for the benefit of a lot of our listeners who may not have a very clear sense of Slovene literature or its canonical works, could you perhaps offer some kind of brief summary of what are some of the foundational texts in Slovene literature? What are some of the most important trajectories and currents in Slovene literature? Could you perhaps try and introduce all of this in a very condensed way? Like, you know, give the whole history of Slovene literature in less than 5 minutes or something like that.
Well, I think it's a very rich literature and with a lot of different influences. So today we have very diverse, which Liv can attest to also, literature. It's very difficult for me to talk about Slovene literature because it's not what I've been doing. It's very different from what Dušan Šarotar has been doing, or Mojica Kumerdej, or of course, Drago Jančar, probably the famous writer, Slovenian writer at the moment. And there are influences from different literature cultures that are very important for what we are doing. And of course, because Slovenia is at a crossroads between German world, it's on the edge of the Balkans, of course. And from the one side, there is a Hungarian influence. And we know how great Hungarian literature is, and then from the other side it's Italian culture. So all these different cultures is what makes, I think, Slovenian literature so interesting, that probably everyone could find a Slovenian writer which suits him or her. So I would say, for me, our greatest writer and one of the great, I think, European or world writers, but sadly not so known around the world, is Lojze Kovačić. His work is tremendous. Newcomers, I think it's translated into English. It's a story about Second World War and aftermaths of the Second World War. And it's really interesting perspective. It's something that today we would call autofiction. But today when you read in Knausgard, you constantly are going back to Lojze Kovačić and thinking, wow, we had something like that 50 years ago. And of course, I mentioned Drago Jančar, who is, of course, very well known. He's a, let's say, Nobel Prize candidate. Probably won't get it, but would be a worthy winner. And then I think we have a lot of different younger writers who are now making their way up trying to get a shine of light in this huge global literature world. I mentioned Dušan Šarotar, I mentioned Mojica Kumerdej. Maybe we should mention some poets also, Anja Golob, Katja Perat.
Could I just briefly mention that I spoke to Katja Perat and she's great. I did an interview with her on her book, The Masochist, from Istros Books, and she was a very fascinating person to speak to.
She's really cool.
Sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
You said briefly, so I think I was I spoke at length. But yes, I encourage everyone to dig into Slovenian literature, because I really believe they can find the right who they will be blown up by because really there is a lot of very interesting works of literature, some great short stories, poetry. I think we are even better poets than we are fiction writers. So yes, you just need to find the courage and of course a good translators.
Absolutely, absolutely. You've just reminded me of a quote which I read while I was researching into Slovene literature a little bit. And I forget who it's from, but it was a Slovene literary critic that said that basically the Slovenes are a nation of poets. And this whole series that we're doing on Traffic Europe Radio, which is called The Middle Ground, is all about literature from Central and Eastern Europe, from Slovakia, Slovenia, Hungary, Romania, Ukraine, the Balkans. So yeah, we're hoping to give a platform to all this kind of writing, because we also believe that there is some exceptional writing coming from these areas. So If we could, I'd like us now to turn to the book The Fig Tree, written by Goran and translated by Olivia. And perhaps the best way to segue into this would be if we heard a reading from the book. So let's begin with a brief excerpt in original Slovene, followed by the corresponding English translation, please. So if you could just perhaps set this up for us as well, provide any necessary context so we can understand what we're hearing, and then we can discuss in greater depth what's going on in this section of the book and indeed in the rest of the book. So yeah, please go ahead.
What we will read is from the beginning of the book, which begins with the death of Alexander, one of the main characters, and after his death, his daughter Vesna and his grandson come into the house, and they're digging around the house, looking for some stuff, just thinking about the past and everything. And while Vesna is going through some old photographs, Jadran is searching for an answer. Why did his grandfather died? Because he somehow believes there is another explanation, even though he was very old and had a bad heart. Imagination sometimes works wild when you are sad. I will just read a few paragraphs in Slovenian. Na veždani slik z njune poroke, nobenih slik nimata iz časov, ko sta bila mlada, nobenih slik, ko sva bili z majo majhni, spočitni, z rojstnodnevnih zabav, nič. Imata slike za osebne izkaznice. Prve slike, na katerih sta oba, so znajne poroke. Predtem pa nič. Njuna zgodba ni ovekovečena. Poznamo jo le takšno, kakršno sta nam sama povedala, kot v knjigah. Nihče drug ne more povedati njune zgodbe drugače, kot sta jo sama želela povedati. A ni to lepo? Pravlično. Ostale so samo slike, ki smo si jih mi ustvarili v svojih glavah ob njunem pripovedovanju. Sklonil sem se pod dedkovo posteljo in pobral stav prazno, rjavo stekleničko. Prepoznal sem jo. Mislil sem, da je steklenička ležala tam vse od njene smrti, da se je tudi ona kot mnoge druge drobnarije valjala po kotih dedkove hiše in se neopažena prašila. A prahu na njej ni bilo, kar je pomenilo, da je ležala tam spodaj šele dan, največ dva.
Do you know, there were no photos from their wedding. Not a single photo of them when they were young. No photos of Maya and me when we were little, from holidays or birthday parties. Nothing. They have passport photos. The first photos of the two of them together were from my wedding. Before that, nothing to immortalize their story. We only know their story as they told it, like in books. The only way their story can be told is the way they wanted to tell it. Isn't that beautiful? Like a fairy tale. The only pictures we're left with are the ones our minds created as we listen to their storytelling. I crouched down under Grandad's bed and picked up a small, empty, brown bottle from the floor. It was familiar. There used to be blue and white capsules inside. Grandma's blood pressure tablets. The bottle had been lying there ever since her death, I thought. Like so many other small objects, it had rolled around in the corners of Grandad's house and gathered dust out of sight. But it wasn't dusty, which meant it had been down there for a day or two at the most.
Thank you. You just heard Goran and Olivia reading from The Fig Tree, out now from Easterlos Books. And I thought that was a very useful excerpt to use to introduce the book and to start having a conversation about the book, because it illustrates a couple of things which I think are really central to the book in terms of narrative form and in terms of plot development, because the narrative in the book unfolds to a large extent via flashbacks and recall and things like this. It's a very non-linear narrative, and there's a lot of recall and there's a lot of people replaying memories, which can be sometimes quite, you know, unreliable, of course. But I also think that's kind of indicative about another theme which is quite central to the book, and another element of the book which I think is really important, and that's this sense that I have of there being a lack of resolution. At times it feels like there's certain secrets being kept throughout the book and there's certain events which are never quite fully explained. I had this sense of there being a lack of resolution and a lack of certainty around what's actually going on, independent of what people in the book are saying is going on. So how did you, Goran, arrive at this approach, at this way of telling a story? Is this narrative structure something that you've been gravitating towards for a long time, this way of telling a story via flashbacks and in a non-linear structure and this kind of thing.
Yes, it took me quite a while. It took me first few years just to put the story together, or let's say all of the stories I wanted to tell together, to actually realize what is this book I want to write about. It started from a simple idea of the man who just ran away from everything, who cut ties, all his ties, and just went somewhere where nobody knows him. It was a small scene of a guy in somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And from there on, it grew. And when I realized that what I was going to write about, it's a family saga, I already knew that I will not start at the beginning, and so it won't be linear. And I wanted it to have a form of the memory, because inside, your memories are not really in your head. They're not put on shelves year by year. It's like more like a mosaic structure, in where you have all these small pieces that you just putting together in and making logic out of them. It's what we are doing when we tell the story. We put some pictures we have in our head and put them together and try to make some logic out of it. And of course, in between those pictures, there are the dark spaces, the things we forgot, which we have to fill with our imagination. And that's what my main character is doing. He's telling the story of his life, or his parents, his grandparents' lives. And of course, he remembers something, he heard something, but he's also filling it with his own imagination. He's tried to make sense, like we all do when we try to tell our own story. So that's this form, I think, was the most logical one for what I was trying to do. But to find the best way how to start a story, then continue it, and the end, I was doing really a lot of editing after the most of the book was written, or even in between. I was editing all the time, which I do when I'm making films. So I was very familiar with the process of editing before I became a writer. But we rarely speak about editing when we are talking about writing. But for me, the editing is the very important process, because looking for the right structure, putting one scene in front of another or vice versa, I think it's the most important thing when you're telling the story. So here it was a really long process, even before I started writing, and then after I started writing. The writing was just, I think, 1/5 of all the work done on this book.
Thank you. And turning to you now, Olivia. Olivia, as a translator, I wanted to ask you about some challenges that you may have faced in the process of translation, given that this book is very firmly located in a specific cultural and social context, one which a lot of Anglophone readers may not well have that much prior knowledge of. So there would obviously be some challenges as a translator that you would face when you're trying to reproduce that same social and cultural context, which is, you know, vital to the plot and the character development in this specific book. And on that subject, I think, you know, the cultural and social context is quite important. You know, the character's identity is important, and national identity is important to the characters, and it determines to a certain extent their psychological makeup, and it to a certain extent governs how they interact with each other and conditions the nature of their relationships. But I don't want to overstate this either. The book's not just an exploration of identity. It's not just a book about political identity and political divisions. It's not, you know, the great identity novel or anything like that. As Gordon has said, it's basically a family saga. But the inclusion of identity, you know, it's not gratuitous or tokenistic whatsoever, you know, because it's a family saga that's located in a region with a very contentious history of political and ethnic divisions and political divisions along ethnic lines. So all of that context is somewhat crucial to understanding the characters' motivations and their psychology. So as a translator, what specific challenges did you face in trying to reproduce and preserve that vital, crucial context and setting and information in translation. Were there any specific words, anything that was encoded at the semantic level which you felt warranted special attention, or perhaps anything in the way that characters spoke to each other, any certain personal forms of address or dialect, shifts in register, anything like this which forced you to kind of be creative or engage in some lateral thinking to come up with some solutions? Anything at all, please just feel free to talk about anything that you feel is relevant here.
Thanks, Joe. That's a really big question. And when you put it like that, I almost think, yeah, this could have been quite a daunting task. And of course it was. There were so many challenges about this novel, but I think it's important to say also that the other side of my work, the academic side of my research, has long focused on this cultural space, on that history. And so for me, I was already thankfully well versed in the context, which allowed me to feel not confident, but well informed, and in a position to be able to make decisions in tandem with, of course, always speaking to Goran when I felt that was necessary. One of the hardest things, and something that I was pondering way before I actually sat down at my computer and started typing the first words, was what I was going to do with the language of Jadran's father, Safet, who is Bosnian. Because in the Slovene novel, Safet speaks Nashki, which I refer to in the translator's note as Bosnian, simply because we know that Safet is from Bosnia. But Safet and some of the other characters refer to this language as Nashki, which means our language, which is what we would now call Bosnian, Serbian, Croatian, Macedonian. Is that right? Am I going to start any fights here, Goran?
Well, Macedonian is... Macedonian, I think, is a different language. Yes, Montenegrin, I think. Yes, we have a great, really huge problem with this language, which is basically, of course, one language that used to be called Serbo-Croatian, and of course, then politically divided into four different languages: Croatian, Bosnian, Serbian, and Montenegrin. And of course, when you're writing literature, political choices or decisions are useless. So when we talk about literature, there is only one language, because the differences between them are like differences between English, or American and British English, or Australian English. And we know that there is one English literature world, no matter which English does the writer use. So it's the same with this language with which I called, like, many people are calling it Nashki, or our language. But we are in the process of understanding, again, after these years of political, how do I say, kidnapping of our language, that's what it was, to claim this language back, to say, okay, we can call it in different ways, but the roots of this is the same language, we all understand each other. There are some differences, but when you're writing, it's only one language, yes. And that's why also this cultural literature space, they try to divide in many different ways, but it doesn't work, actually, because Bosnian writers writing in Bosnia are publishing in Croatia. Also, Montenegrin writers are publishing in Croatia. And then some other Bosnian writers are publishing in Serbia. So it's, of course, if you want to strictly divide authors by their nationality, of the place of birth or the place where they live, you just create one huge mess. And that's why we have a lot of actually awards that are for writers that are writing in Bosnian, Croatian, Serbian, and Montenegrin, because it is the same literature space. And most festivals, literature festivals, are actually regional festivals. And the biggest publishers in Croatia and Serbia are regional publishers. And they are only referring to this regional literature because they know that you cannot really divide the language, even if you know that there are some differences between Serbian version of this language and Croatian version of this language. But those differences are not so big that we can talk about different languages. But yes, we still have a great problem with the name of that language.
The naming is where it gets really sticky. And so that is what was one of the major problems for me in translating it. Because if I tried to then pick that apart and explain it, it's a very subjective explanation. And there might be others who didn't necessarily agree with those denominations, or etc. So there was a lot to think about. And in practical terms, I had to think about how I was going to translate Safet's language, what he was saying. Because the whole point, and as Goran has just summarized for us, what Safet was saying in Nashki was mutually intelligible for the characters in the book. And for Slovene readers reading, it's partly generational, and I can't speak for any Slovene readers personally, but a Slovene reader is going to have a much better chance of reading and understanding than an Anglophone reader is going to have. If I were to leave his Nashki as it was, untranslated, we're missing an enormous section of the book. So that was never an option. It's not like leaving the odd word or phrase in the source language. It's an entire character. But of course, the fact that he uses that language is highly significant. And so it wasn't something that I wanted to just completely ignore and erase. I thought about ways that I could maintain a visual difference in the text, for example. So maybe I considered at first I could leave what Safet says in italics to always remind the reader that Safet is speaking Nashki and the other characters are speaking Slovene. But then, of course, when you get into the book deeper and deeper, you realise that there is a lot of sections of the dialogue that are in italics, and that this has a very important function. It distinguishes between dialogue as recalled or fictionalised by Yadran and dialogue that is happening in the present. And so using italics to denote Safet's dialogue was not an option. So it's not very satisfactory, but I did the best that I could. I occasionally would leave lines of Nashki in there. For instance, there's some song lyrics that I left in there because it's clear that what Safet is doing in that moment is singing. And I felt that to give that sense that, yeah, he sings in Nashki, that was okay. And for me as a reader, I quite like that occasionally. I like something that's going to pique my curiosity that I can then go and look up. And if you leave the song lyrics in the source language, if you enter that into Google, you're going to find the song and you can immediately hear what Safet is singing in the shower, which I think is really fun. So there were little things like that that I tried to leave in where I could. And then I had to do the rest of the legwork with a translator's note, explaining the context the best I could. But yeah, obviously, it is a huge part of the book that doesn't come across in the same way in the English as it does in the Slovene. It's inevitable. That's different. But I hope that people still got the sense of his character. I hope that the context of his relationship with the other characters was clear. And even though it was all very challenging linguistically, I always felt reassured, almost held by the strength of the characters. I could see that in spite of what I wasn't able to do linguistically, there was still a character emerging on the page that I loved and that still, you know, stays with me.
Well, if it's any further reassurance to you, then yes, a very strong character definitely came across to me as well on the page. Yeah, I wanted to talk further about this actually, because in the world of the book, as we've talked about, national identity is quite prominent and it's quite a significant component of human psychology in the book, and it governs people's motivations and their interactions with one another to a certain extent. But, you know, people are, you know, obviously not being reduced to their national identities, which is something which I think is really cool about the book, that the characters are very multidimensional, complicated, with deep, rich psychologies. But on the subject of national identity, if there were two national identities which seem to be most starkly juxtaposed in the book, it would probably be Bosnian and Slovenian, because as we've talked about, Safet, who is Yadran's father, is Bosnian and he lives in Slovenia, and he seems to be quite often at odds with his environment when he's in Slovenia. And I get a sense that the book kind of plays with some ideas about stereotypes, about national character and how various national characters are kind of stereotyped in different countries, i.e. In Slovenia, Bosnians are sometimes stereotyped as being somewhat rough around the edges and compared to Slovenians, who are perhaps caricatured as being more mild-mannered and a bit more reserved and perhaps even a little bit cynical. I think Slavoj Žižek gets a reference with his cynicism. And one scene, for instance, which kind of stuck with me was somebody says, in Slovenia, we don't trust people who laugh. We're not people who laugh out loud, and we think it's slightly suspicious if people do. And somebody says, well, that's because Slovenians are always laughing at other people. Like, if you see a Slovenian laughing, it's probably because somebody has fallen down a hole or something like that. Like, they're probably laughing because something bad has happened to somebody else. So, I don't know, Goran, could you perhaps develop some of this? What were some of the ideas and stereotypes about Bosnian national identity and Slovenian national identity that you were kind of exploring within those relationships in the book?
You refer to the part where I'm really playing with all these stereotypes through two characters that are really, in a way, they're representing their nation, and in a way they are not, they are just playing the game. Actually, Safet and Dane are actually, they just play the game, they form the friendship on these stereotypes, on their images in each other's heads, and it was fun for them. And it's for me, they are much more than that, but somehow they had fun playing Slovenian and Bosnians, which we often do. We want Bosnians to be like Bosnians, and we want Slovenians to be like Slovenians, which makes everything much more simple. But the real life, for me, proved to be much more complicated. And I think this book is about that. It's, of course, in Yugoslavia before the breakup, and of course, then after the war started, we all wanted to divide these people into the nations, Yugoslavs. We wanted to divide them to say, okay, Serbs, these people are Serbs, and they are like Serbs are. And the same goes from Slovenians, Bosnians, and Croats. But my experience is that most people that I knew, which includes also my parents and most of my family, stayed outside these small boxes. And we didn't fit. Me personally also, we didn't fit in any of these boxes. Maybe my father, yes, in a way he was a typical Bosnian, but he was a Bosnian Serb, but his father was a communist. He claimed he didn't want to be called Serb because he was such a huge devoted fan of communism and Yugoslavia. And my father never felt like a Serbian. My mother was even more complicated. She grew up in Croatia, in Istria, but her parents came from Bosnia. They were from Ukrainian and Bosniaks. So they never spoke about nationalities before, and they were forced to start thinking about their own nationality suddenly when they were like 40 years old. And they were forced to explain this new concept to us, to the kids. So for 10 years, nationality didn't exist, and then you were explained this concept by people who didn't know anything about it. It took years and years for this, I think, old region from Slovenia to Macedonia to understand that there are something like complex identities, to understand that people could be Slovenian and Bosnian and Croatian, to understand that people could be none of it and could belong to wider space, and to understand that there is something like a Yugoslavian nationality, because people grew to be Yugoslavs and nothing else. So it took a lot of time to realize that this word, that is the huge part of my book, really exists. That there are people like Alexander, who doesn't have a really clear nationality, or Safet, who is a Bosnian in Slovenia, but not really typical Bosnian because he never lived in Bosnia. So he can feel in Bosnia even bigger stranger than he feels in Slovenia. And of course, at the end, who is Yadran and what he is? It's the question of the book. He tries to find who he is with all these non-clean ancestors. And of course, these are the questions that we all ask ourselves. And the problem was, when I was growing up, that there wasn't many answers to those questions. They were like, okay, you can be Slovenian, you can be Serbian, you can be Bosnian, and that's it. So now, finally, we are understanding that there are as many answers as there are people, and that this place is that Yugoslavia was a multicultural, multi-ethnical space, which created different experiences and different nationalistic feelings. And that, of course, people have the right to feel like they want to feel. It's, but if I just go a little way back into our conversation and get back to the question about the language and the naming, which I think is very connected to the topic we speak about, I would just say how complicated it is, because I had to name the language my parents are speaking for my kids. I have to explain them, okay, me and my wife, we are speaking Slovenian with you, but your grandfather and your grandmother are speaking. So what are they speaking? So we choose to name it Bosnian, because for us it was no simple to say, okay, your grandfather is from Bosnia, so he speaks Bosnian. And of course, my mother was a little bit disappointed, because she was like, okay, my language is a little bit different. I come from Croatia. Why should I speak Bosnian? But then, and we were trying to explain, look, we don't want to complicate things for the 3 years old. We know that are much more complicated, but they will learn one day that it's not really Bosnian. But for now, can we speak about Bosnian language? And my mother was okay. She somehow agreed, but she wasn't really satisfied. But it's in practical terms, we don't have even the language that supports this kind of multi-ethnical, multicultural feelings that we have, because we didn't create one, not even in Yugoslavia. We didn't call the language Yugoslavian language, because there were so many nationalistic tensions that this Yugoslav project could only went thus far to not to endanger the existence of this one nationality, strict nationalities, Croatian, Serbian, Slovenian, and else.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, your point about people kind of performing the stereotypes and kind of taking ownership of the stereotypes and inhabiting it for kind of a game, you know, like in a playful way. That's kind of what they're doing, right? They have this kind of quite antagonistic but playful relationship where they're constantly making fun of each other based on the national stereotypes which exist. But it was, you know, quite interesting that the way that manifests itself in that specific relationship, because it actually masks a genuine tension and conflict that's going on between them. So it makes that relationship quite interesting and complex.
Yeah, it's more charged in that context, isn't it? Because of what's actually happening in reality politically. Just as Goran was explaining that, I was trying to find this passage about Alexander, and it's how Vesna is explaining how Alexander saw his own identity. And I wondered if I could just read this little section, because I think it really sums up a lot of what Goran was just saying. So this is Vesna talking about Alexander, the grandfather. He was about as communist as he was Serbian. He was as communist as he needed to be in order to get a bit of peace from the communists. He couldn't be anything. He wouldn't have been capable of believing in God, nor the party, nor the state, even if he'd wanted to. His life's motto was, you keep your distance and I'll keep mine. He was incapable of making connections with anyone or anything. Being part of something simply wasn't in his DNA. He loathed cooperation. He didn't get it. He was never we. He was always just himself, on his own, Alexander Georgievich. And then it goes on a little bit, and then there's this really important line, I think, which I spent so long translating this line. There were so many versions. It went on forever. But if you don't see yourself as one of us, then you can't see others as one of them. And that, for me, is like one of those, it just sums up that whole problem of that confusion, the situation that people like Alexander found themselves in that moment, the madness of it all, of people being put into categories. How does that even work when you haven't even had any prior concept of those categories separately in the first place?
I like that line a lot too. I like it a lot. It kind of speaks to that reality that sometimes the construction of a coherent, cohesive identity to quite an extent often depends on defining who is not part of that cohesive, coherent group identity. You quite often need to frame people as other in order to have a sense of belonging to one group. And sometimes the basis of inclusion is kind of exclusion of others, you know? So we're kind of coming to the end a little bit now. But before we finish, could we talk about a little bit about how this book and how it succeeds in exploring and examining these quite hotly contested identities and these very politicized identities, but in a way that kind of bypasses a lot of the politics and does so with a certain lightness of touch and a real skill and a real deftness, in the sense that these people that, you know, there's Slovene characters in the book and there's Bosnian characters in the book, and everybody's got, you know, everybody's very much aware of how much their national identity is going to inform other people's expectations of them and other people's relationships with them. And national identity is kind of always there in the background, very present in people's realities. But as we've said before, you know, this is a book about relationships. This is a book about very complex psychologies and how they're relating to each other in intimate ways. And I think your book does a very good job in examining and exploring those tensions that those identities can produce, but in a non-politicized and non-confrontational way. So perhaps if either of you had any comments on this subject, Olivia, how did you experience some of this when you were reading the book in the first place and then afterwards as a translator?
I think one of the things that I loved about the book, one of the reasons I loved the book so much when I first read it as a reader, was how, of course, you know, as in other works by Goran, the Yugoslav context and the history is integral to his work. That's Goran's world. So it's there. But with The Fig Tree, I loved how it also wasn't really about that, like we said. I loved the fact that this book just immersed me in this world with these characters that were funny, that taught me things, that made me think, that stayed with me. And that for me was what it was all about. It's a really quiet internal book for me. And every time I dip back into it, I find new things. There's so many layers to it. It really made me think. And I think that's what a good book does. So in a way, that was quite straightforward for me. It was just simply an absolutely brilliant book that completely took me somewhere else, that immersed me, that made me laugh, that made me cry, that made me feel things. And yeah, that was why I was absolutely desperate to translate it, really, as soon as I think I've said before that if you look at my Slovene copy of The Fig Tree, there's loads of like pencil scribbles in the margins and me thinking how I would say this in English, making notes from the moment I first read it. So it definitely started sparking ideas in my head.
Goran, would you like to have the final word then here on this subject? Anything at all you'd like to contribute?
Well, when you asked the question, I was also thinking something similar, like Olivia just told you, right? Because I always refer to this book as a book about love and then everything else. Because my first two books, I think, dealt with most of my, Yugoslav trauma. And they were different because of it. And with this book, of course, if you want to write a love story in the Balkans, you cannot avoid politics, because all our lives, even the tiniest, more intimate parts are happening always inside some context, which political, historic context. But I was much more interested in this intimate spaces between characters than I was interested in the context, of course. And I love the fact that this book can be read in different ways, that some people refer it as a very political book, that they are writing about it like about, it's a book about the breakup of Yugoslavia. But I think from my experience, it enables very different reading. And a lot of people are reading it like Olivia did, regardless of this context. So yeah, about the characters, about their lives, about their relationships, about their intimate crisis. And then only then you get also the context, because I see it as a book of my life. And of course, the politics are the huge part of it. And it played a lot of things happened because of politics. It's why my grandparents moved to Istria, why at the end I ended up in Slovenia. It's, and how then everything evolved. It basically, I think the breakup of Yugoslavia defines me as a person, and how I see the world and how I understand a human being probably. But then again, I hope there is more to my writing than just this. And I just let the world be in this book as I see it, as a much more complex, much more full of a lot of different stuff. Not, my second book was about the war crimes and searching for answers, how people can commit them and how things can get really ugly. But this book, I tried to capture a wider picture with where these few characters are living fuller lives, where of course politics plays its part, but it's not the only part. And of course, their identities are much more complex. The way they see themselves, it's much more complicated, much more blurry, I would say. They don't have a clear picture, none of them, because from my world, there is rarely a very vivid picture of oneself. It's always changing. You always have some doubts. Sometimes you feel very good in your skin, and sometimes the next day you are questioning yourself and who you are. My identity the way I see the identity is something like it's fluid. It's something very fluid. It's something that is never final. It's like, I'm not the same person that I was 10 years ago, not even the same person that wrote this book. It's constantly changing. My experience is changing. I'm not so confused as I was as a teenager, but I have much more answers now that I didn't have back then. But still, if I had all the answers, I would probably stop writing. If I knew the answers to all these questions, I would just tell it to you right now, and then there would be no need for me to write another book. But obviously, I'm still writing and still searching for answers.
Yeah, it's absolutely, yeah, you know, resonates with me. What you just said about identities, you know, identities are a process, you know, they're not an end point. They're constantly in flux and they're constantly responding to external and internal stimuli. So they can be much more fluid and much less stable than sometimes people make out. Well, thank you for a wonderful conversation. Before we go, could you each just tell us what your next projects are, what you're working on at the moment, and what can we expect to see from either of you in the future? Olivia?
Okay, so I, a few months ago, handed in a translation of a children's book, which I don't think is coming out till next year, but it's a really beautiful book with amazing illustrations. It's called Adam and His Tuba. It might just be called Adam in English, by a Slovene author called Žiga Gombač. So that is coming out next year. I'm also working on a couple of short stories. We are applying for funding from English Pen, so don't know yet whether that project will happen, but I've been working with another translator from BCS, Will Firth, on hopefully putting together a project, but we'll see. I won't say any more about that yet, because we'll see how it goes.
One is that I'm actually finishing book of nonfiction, which was meant to be like my second collection of my columns or some texts, but then I realized that in 10 years since I published the first collection of my columns, a lot of different texts emerge. And then, so now it's turning out to be a collection of very autobiographical essays. And it's not so non-fiction as maybe even autofictional collection. And it's something that's, I think it will be very interesting for people to read. Most of these texts were already published, but in different languages. Some people will recognize, some they will be a little bit surprised. Some, of course, are, let's say, rewrites, or most of them are a little bit freshen up. So yeah, it's going to be, it's called The Collector of Fears. So that's a book I'm working on, and it should be out in, if not this year, then the beginning of the next. And the second thing, the second project that I'm working on is I'm going to direct in the theater for the first time. It's sort of a sweet and sour feeling, because I'm directing the text of my late writer and director, Marco Sausage, my friend who passed away this January. And I jumped in and we are now preparing a play that he was supposed to direct, his own play, which is very similar to his literature, which I really love. Yeah, Marco Sausage is another, he's a writer from, Slovenian writer from Trieste, writes beautifully. So yeah, I would also suggest his works for people.
Yeah, there are some translated, I think Ballerina is translated into first English. I can't remember who translated it, I'm afraid, yeah. But it does exist. So well,
this is a project that's been very important to me, because it's some, as I said, the first time I will direct in theater. And then it's also because Marco and his things were very important to me. And it's going to be a very interesting process for all us all, because most of these people that will work on this play was somehow on the other way connected to him in his world. So yes.
Okay. That sounds great. Thank you. We'll look forward to seeing all of your projects in the near future. Best of luck with everything. And thank you very much for joining me today. It was a pleasure to speak to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Slovene author Goran Vojnovic and translator Olivia Hellowell in conversation with Joe Williams on The Fig Tree, published by Istros Books.
You've been listening to The Middle Ground, a series focusing on Central and Eastern European literary cultures. This series is produced by Trafica Europe Radio. Check out our audio and other literary content at traficaeurope.org.
I'm Clayton McKee, and on behalf of everyone at Trafica Europe Radio, thanks for listening.